All right, let's do this. Peanut, if you're staying in the room, no talking.
Hello, and welcome to the PhotoWork Podcast, the talky, touchy, feely version of Sasha Wolf's book, PhotoWork, 40 Photographers on Process and Practice. I am Michael Chauvin Dalton, the professor, or maybe Gilligan, of the SS PhotoWork. So you're probably wondering, where is Sasha? Well, Sasha and I had a lovely week at the Chico Portfolio Review in Chico Hot Springs, Montana. And on top of that very intense week of reviewing portfolios and just being with some amazing people, Sasha is in the middle of buying a house. So this week, you get me. But don't worry, because while I was at Chico, I had the absolute pleasure to record with Ray Meeks for my show, and we decided that it makes sense to release this episode on both our shows because this is really a follow-up to when Ray was on this show back in episode 51, and he was describing to Sasha a brand new body of work that has now become his latest book, The Inhabitants, published by Mack. But before we get to that, I do have some announcements from our wonderful sponsor, Picture House in the Small Darkroom. On Thursday, April 4th, Jim Magin will be discussing his monograph, The Crick, with New York Times photo editor Jacqueline Bates. That's April 4th. On Tuesday, April 9th, Ian Lewandowski will give an artist talk in conjunction with his solo show called The Colossus at Clamp Gallery. That exhibition is on view until April 27th. But again, that talk is on April 9th. And then Tim Carpenter and Charlie Simakaitis will be doing a joint signing on Wednesday, April 24th. This is for Tim's new book with The Ice Plant called Little. Charlie Simakaitis is releasing his debut book with TIS called The Crisis Tapes. And the two artists will be in conversation during the event. And again, that is on April 24th. Check out Picture House in the Small Darkroom at phtsdr.com and phtsdr on Instagram, and also phtsdr_books on Instagram. And of course, also check them out for their printing, processing, and production services. So this is a really wonderful conversation I have with Ray Meeks, but I have to give you a little bit of a nerd warning. In the first roughly 10-15 minutes of the show, Ray and I get into a conversation about description and detail that involves f-stops and depth of field. So it's actually a really fun conversation, and it is relevant to the work that we are going to talk about from The Inhabitants, in that description and detail and how you represent both the human spirit and human suffering in a way that's not exploitative and transactional is something that Ray deals with in this book. And the experience does have an effect on Ray's practice and the way he thinks about making photographs and his role as a photographer. So at this point, Sasha would say, Michael, please take it away. And I will just say, my pleasure. Here is my conversation with Ray Meeks. Hi, Ray. Thanks for joining me here
at
Chico.
Yeah. Pleasure.
yeah. So we had our first lecture with Jenya Friedland today, our first speaker, and that was pretty good.
Amazing. Yeah. She's so eloquent. She gives just great thought to what she's doing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And trying to understand and being able to articulate that.
Yeah. So you were on with Sasha Wolf not too long ago. In a sort of perfect way, you ended your conversation with Sasha talking about this work that you were doing with migration. Mm-hmm. And it was very early in terms of how you were looking at the work and still thinking about the work. And now this is a book called The Inhabitants. And so we want to talk about that today. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, just to remind people, you know, give us a little background of how you got into all of this. Where you're from?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio. Didn't have a lot of background, formative background that would suggest that I would spend most of my life making pictures, or all of my adult life making pictures. Came to photography. There was a time I'd say by accident. Now it seems more like, you know, this is where I was supposed to land. And I guess, you know, on Sasha's show, I talked a little bit about the origin story, you know, of it, of like coming to photography. But yeah. I've mostly, you know, done things, been self-taught in most parts, although, you know, none of us are truly self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of people take me under wing, and all they ask in exchange was that I do some relief for somebody else down the road. So I've tried to do that. Is just, you know, give back and continue nurturing the community in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Such a hard thing to talk about.
Yeah.
How you began, why you began. But mm-hmm. I had no question about, you know, like I'm pretty sure I'm doing one of the things I was put here to do.
Right.
I just haven't quite yet settled on exactly why, you know, like where the end, you know, like what is the end result? But lately it seems more like that I might have, it might provide a portal to reach younger people also, you know, mm-hmm. by way of teaching or by way of these workshops.
Yeah.
As I get to the advanced age of 60.
You and I are actually close in age. Yes. But, you know, I've heard you talk about your practice in a way that is very book oriented, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Well, I'm book oriented in a sense that I don't make pictures towards a known subject. I don't really start out with a project. Mm-hmm. I go through periods of making pictures intensively, followed by similar to now, like a stretch of time where I really don't carry a camera with me at all. I make very few pictures, and it's usually because I'm in the middle of editing work, you know, making a book, working on an exhibition, something like that, where I'm, the process of making pictures is separate from the process of making a book.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say though, that like, it doesn't feel like I've stepped out of a practice. It just feels like an extension of the practice. And when I come back to making pictures, I learn as much from the editing of my work, like the amount of time I've spent with my work editing it. That feels like is part of the evolution also of how I make pictures and what I'm interested in and what I'm curious about.
Yeah, that is as much part of the creative process as that editing.
I think especially like visually how, like I notice when I step back out to make pictures now, I'm framing differently. Mm. I'm interested in a different sort of composition and an activation of the edges and the foregrounds, and my use of apertures has become much more refined since The Inhabitants.
Oh, interesting.
Being deliberate about depth of field, being deliberate about, you know, like the stitching together of backgrounds with foregrounds mm-hmm. or not. It seems so like I used to be totally about wanting to isolate
with a shallow depth of field.
And now I just find myself at F16 almost all the time.
Wow.
Just trying to like stitch this thing together and let things line up.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think when you use that shallow depth of field, you can't help but feel like you're pandering in a way by way of pointing.
I get that.
Or isolating for the viewer. Like, you know, it feels a bit like pandering to the viewer, like not trusting that they can isolate themselves or pull meaning of their own from the picture without isolating and sort of spelling it out for them.
There is an inherent also romanticism to that
completely.
Shallow depth of field an allusion to the idea of memory too, I think, when you get to that sort of foggy background, that soft background.
It creates an ethereality.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And I tired of hearing people talk or say to me that my pictures felt like dreams.
Right, of course. You know? Right. Yeah, yeah. And of course, there is a place for it, and you've used it really well. But now embracing this idea of deep depth of field and stitching together foreground and background, which I've never really heard anyone talk about it that way, that must feel like opening up all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's more true to the way the eye sees. It just means that like not using shallow depth of field as much as I used to is sort of closing one door that allows for another door to open. And I'm considering other elements of composition. I'm not shy of cropping my pictures, you know, and that allows me more possibility in cropping my pictures. But mostly it just feels like using shallow depth of field feels a bit like a crutch or like an affect.
It
feels easy.
Maybe even more importantly for you, it's something you need to shake off to keep making new work.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
To allow something new to come to emerge. Like it's that new... A new opening, like I said, one door closes, another opens. So,
and did some of that deeper depth of field? You know, there's no good phrase for deep depth of field.
There isn't.
So clumsy.
There isn't. Deeper depth of field.
Deep depth of field, long depth of field.
We'll just say like stopping down to stopping down.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, closing down.
Stopping down, closing down. So you can tell how long someone's been photographing by which phrase they use.
Yeah, and closing down is actually the opposite of what it is.
Right.
It's more of like opening up.
I know. Now you're really going to confuse everybody.
Well, I mean, you know, like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, closing down, like when you narrow a depth of field and you just focus on a single subject, it closes down around that single thing, you know?
Nothing confuses my students more when I accidentally say a large aperture or a small aperture.
I know. What does that mean?
That's right. Which number? Big number, small number?
Right. And you think with a smaller number, you're getting...
Yeah. The smaller aperture.
Yeah.
And you're not. Wow. We really went down a nerdy rabbit hole there.
We went down a narrow aperture.
But did some of this deeper depth of field, I think some of this started to show up in Somersault, right?
Yes, it did. It actually did. It wasn't an absolute thing. It was more of also then starting to become the cover image. The portrait of my daughter is a wide open depth of field where it does isolate the subject. That's more of a traditional pinned butterfly type of portrait.
That more landscape garden work.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
So I was working with 4x5 and I was working with Pentax 6.7.
Mm.
And with the 6.7, I'm more inclined to want to stop down more.
Yeah.
It's also just a default of vision. My vision not being as good as it used to be and just not feeling so certain about shallow depth of field.
Maybe I better just stop this down to 11
just to make sure I got, you know.
That was a big change for me when I started wearing glasses. How uncertain I became of the sharpness of my photographs.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That would, oh my God.
But there's something about paging through a book of pictures where you do become aware at a certain point of that deliberateness when I'm looking at other books of the use of the instrument and of shutter, of the relationship between shutter and aperture, you know, and like being really deliberate about that instrument and how you use it to make a picture and what it will, you know, what it will add. I do oftentimes end up, you know, making one wide open and one stop down.
Oh, no, right.
Yeah, because you just don't know, like, where that image is going to fall in the book. And if at this point in the book, it can be included and sequenced in the section of the book that it's in simply by way of that choice, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
Do you want to reinforce a shallow depth of field or reinforce, you know, more detail? So I do tend to sometimes make two exposures.
You know, it's funny that we're having this conversation about shutter speeds and apertures and really like the meat and potatoes of photography.
Mm-hmm.
After listening to Jenya Friedland make quotes about Sharkovsky, who of course wrote that every photographer faces the same sort of five things, you know, vantage point, time.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Wait.
I hope you'll
frame,
get it.
Frame, vantage, time, detail, and the thing itself, right?
Yeah. I would have gotten one of those. I would have gotten time. but I think photography has become a very accessible medium. And I think what you see from photographers who have seemingly had a quick leap into, you know, making pictures that find their way, you know, that they're making books and they're having exhibitions and they're finding some success, whatever that word means way. But what you notice a lot of times is that there isn't a lot of emphasis given to the instrument.
The tool, right.
There isn't a lot of consideration to that. And a lot of them have come up, not to sound too much of a curmudgeon or anything, but like they have not come up, you know, working in the darkroom, you know, with analog process. And so they don't know restraint.
I always talk about, because I teach both black and white and digital, and I always talk about how much higher the stakes are in the black and white class.
In black and white, you teach analog.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's so many steps along the way where things can go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, you're raising the stakes. And so you become much more thoughtful about the process and the settings and everything else.
Yeah. The stakes are what?
The stakes are high in that things can go wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when
you could lose.
And when they do, it costs money too.
Like that's right.
The dark room is expensive.
Yeah. The dark room is expensive. Yeah.
Paper is not as cheap as nearly as cheap as it once was.
Yeah.
But I also think that when things go wrong is when things start to go right oftentimes, you know, and that's the thing that I miss most of all about. I was talking with Todd Heido a couple of days ago, and I've known Todd for a long time. And there were times at Todd's talks, his lectures, where it would always come up like support Kodak, buy more film, you know? And now he's shooting all digital, and it's
right.
He's so satisfied or gratified by that experience of making his pictures digitally and in printing them digitally. And I just said, yeah, but Todd, I used to go into the dark, been in the dark room with you. Like, don't you miss those light leaks or fogging the paper or overexposing a full stop and realize you don't need shadow detail there. You know, you're holding on to something that, is better to let go into the void where like the, now the imagination, the viewer's imagination is activated by that shadow, you know? And you don't have as many interactions with chance or contingency outside of that analog process.
But I would say, and on Todd's behalf, and not that Todd needs me to speak on his behalf, he has that bank, that experience.
For sure.
And, you know, and so his decision-making in digital comes from a wealth of information.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's informed by... It's informed by the inherent restraint that is in the dark room, that comes in the dark room.
But, and that is what maybe starting from digital, you know, that's, you have to learn some other way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, just one last note on aperture and depth of field.
We have not talked about the inhabitants at all yet.
This is my segue.
Okay. All right.
I think the extended detail you get from a deeper depth of field makes perfect sense for this book, because this book is about a journey. Mm-hmm. This book is about also showing evidence of that journey. Mm-hmm. And so that detail, that attention to a foreground and a background as a kind of showing up a bit of a pathway, a bit of a marker of that someone traveled through, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I think you came to this idea at the right time.
Yeah, I think maybe so. Also, a lot of the places I was photographing, there was so much atmosphere already, ethereality by way of atmosphere.
Right.
In the place that I needed to somehow anchor that image.
Right. There is a little bit of that Atjeh light.
There right? is, for yes. sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even as much as the Atjeh light, I mean, really what I was hoping for, I photographed a lot in the same places and returned to the same places, especially in the beginning of my work on the Bidasoa River in southern France. I return to the same places because I have this, I don't know if it's, if the belief has any grounding or not, but that the more committed one is to a place or a subject, it allows for an unveiling or a revelation of another layer. Like, I think first of all, I love like just thinking about like walking into a landscape, a forest where there was so much happening before you arrived there. There was so much that will happen after you leave. And yet you bring a camera into that place and you bring your attention to that place. And it sort of forces nature's hand where like for a moment, you're going to make an image of this thing that is no longer in movement. There was something about like entering that wild, fluid space and trying to make a picture that somehow still contained that fluidity. When it became an image and you encountered the image, you would not feel a static moment. You would feel like a movement before and a movement that will follow.
Right.
You're looking at the picture, which I think is a very difficult thing to do
completely
in a landscape picture.
Landscape, still photography. We're not talking about motion through shutter speed. We're talking about a feeling of
a pulse.
Moment. Yeah.
A heartbeat.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, before we get too far into this, why don't we introduce the idea of the work and how it all started and give us a sense of that?
Well, I was nominated for this prize called the Immersion...
The Sixth Immersion Laureate.
Thank you.
French-American Photographic Commission. By the way, the first three times I read Sixth Immersion Laureate, I thought it was like a bestowal of royalty, like being knighted.
It is.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I wasn't wrong.
I left my crown outside, but... see the sword.
I forgot to bow when you entered.
You're forgiven this time. Next time I do hope you'll follow protocol.
Off with an ear.
Sixth laureate for somebody who doesn't have a degree is like a wonderful term.
That's lovely.
So I was awarded this commission, and along with the award, I had to submit a proposal for a body of work that I would make in France, and I had the whole country as a possibility. And along with this award was an agreement that I would produce a book with my publisher, which is Mac, and prepare an exhibition for ICP in New York City and an exhibition at Cartier-Bresson in Paris.
This is really incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Gregory Halperin is a friend. He was the fifth or fourth laureate. And he told me about the award after, when he received it years ago. And my thought was like, how do I have to position myself in this world to get that sort of, to have that sort of opportunity? And lo and behold, you know, a couple of years later, I was nominated for it.
Nice.
So yeah, completely indulgent in the sense that I got to devote my time to doing nothing but every day aligning myself in the world with a camera, with my curiosity and my astonishment. The daunting part of it was making pictures outside of a place that I was familiar with, my own country, my own backyard, with these constraints of a timeline, a publication date, exhibition dates, all that I had to sign on to in advance. And I'm not used to working towards a known subject or a deadline.
Right. This is a very different process for you. Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah.
And I had no idea how I was going to negotiate that. At a certain point of writing my proposal, you know, it occurred to me that I don't really even want to photograph in France because I'm so enamored with what's happening in my own immediate world, the people that inhabit it. And, you know, so many questions and curiosities in that space alone, you know, like to take it outside of that space and enter someplace that's not mine, where I don't have agency, where I don't have any sort of authorship or ownership of the place or the people, don't speak the language. So that was a bit daunting also, but I would say that the privilege overwhelmed any sort of fear of discomfort of going to that, of taking on that sort of challenge.
Well, also getting back to what we were talking about earlier, in some ways, this is that darkroom uncertainty, right?
Right.
Like, this is pushing you to discover something. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think I'm going to maybe step ahead a little bit here, but I think what it's taught me is that, you know, I don't know, to be totally cliched about it, you know, home is sort of, we carry home with us, you know. I never really believed that fully, but then when I landed there, the first thing that I found myself wanting to do was identify with the place that felt like home, where I could begin. And this is not like a, you know, not something that revealed itself in a journal entry. It's just something that I found myself gravitating towards sycamore trees in southern France, you know, and rivers that felt like rivers in central southern Ohio where I grew up, because this is now a visual language that I understand and I can begin here. And then I'll, from there, again, not like, not a map, not an intentionality, but I found myself working out from that space. I know this space. I know how to photograph this. I know how to understand this. I still find it astonishing. It still draws me back, but now I can start to like work my way out from that corner.
And then maybe some of the inherent differences of being in France would also reveal itself, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah. And find the particular and the universal within, you know, that space.
Right. So what was the proposal you ended up writing to start this work?
Yeah. So the proposal was my friend, George Weld, who ended up collaborating. I ended up collaborating with George on the writing. I sent him my proposal a day before it had to be submitted.
Were you paired with George Weld?
Not at all. No.
Oh, okay.
No, no.
You knew from the beginning.
It was just me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was only going to be a book of photographs, you know, as far as I knew. It wasn't going to be an image text collaboration. But I sent my proposal to George, and it was a very loose proposal that involved landing in France and sort of following my nose. And George suggested that I be more specific. Where are you going to land? Why are you landing there? And he suggested Calais as the center of the refugee crisis in Europe. And I don't think politically, I don't think socially politically, I don't want to impose that on my work or have an agenda going into a place or try to set up a theory and try to prove or disprove that theory. That's not the way I work. But it felt like a valid way, entering a competition with, you know, five other shortlisted photographers. That felt legitimate. Like I better be serious about anchoring this in a social political, even though my pictures won't be that. So I suggested Calais. And the Burgers of Calais, the story of the Burgers of Calais is sort of a background to it and was awarded the commission based on that proposal. I ended up in southern France by chance, just having a friend who had a condominium in Saint-Jean-de-Luz and ended up working that southern border, which ended up being, you know, just one of those chance happenings serendipity that you later is like, no, this was totally programmed, you know, like not by me, but it was programmed because it allowed me to explore a different part of France. That's also part of a transient passage for refugees, less so than the eastern part of France through Italy, but still pretty significant passage through northern Spain into southern France and to Calais or Dunkirk, you know, and across the English Channel into Britain.
Right.
Yeah, the UK. So it allowed me to make work there in a different setting, a different French culture, and provide, I think, a more expansive way of exploring this subject.
So the book Inhabitants shows photographs of you sort of following this path of or finding these places of refugee crossings and rivers and forests and wastelands, and they are not portraits of or, you know, active encampments of refugees, but this is sort of that evidence of part of the struggle that they went through, the journey they went through, and not all that different from those mid to late 19th century photographs of war where it was after the fact. And I always thought those were incredibly impactful, even though we know some of those were set up and arranged and other things, but they were. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Did I ruin that for you?
Oh my gosh. Brady was...
I'm sorry to tell you, yeah.
Those
the cannonballs.
The cannonballs were not there? That's not AI, is it?
Yeah, that's right. But I always thought that was still very impactful. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an incredible impact with this work, which is sort of after the fact.
I did find active encampments, and I did intend on doing portraits. Portraits was part of my proposal. And so I had volunteered with an agency called Care for Calais.
Yeah. So I think this is where you ended on Sasha's show.
Okay, right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. We did touch on that.
And so, yeah, no, that's why, it's great to pick up how it all worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was volunteering there with the hope that, I don't know, I would establish some feeling of credibility based on my efforts and attempts to know some of the refugees, where they had come from, their stories, as well as contribute to their well-being in a way by working for this organization that was providing them with goods and services, you know, modest goods and services, but still it was their organization, along with a half a dozen others, was providing significant relief for refugees while they were holding, including like providing lawyers.
And, oh, wow.
For folks who did get to the UK, but then were potentially being extradited to other countries. So that was my approach. I began going out to encampments, providing goods, but also speaking with a number of refugees, finding out where they were from, having their stories, made friends with a few of them, found myself interacting with them as in a transactional way, like thinking of them as subjects inherently as a photographer. Like, you know, I found myself gravitating towards features,
right?
Towards individuals who, like, I thought might be good subjects for the camera. That, along with the actual engagement, just felt disingenuous, you know, it felt transactional, and that I was perhaps exploiting or potentially exploiting a relationship.
The potential was there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just felt like it was getting in the way. Like I either wanted to just be open to meeting somebody and gathering by way of their stories, a bit of a character or a personality, and then having that experience inhabit me in such a way that when I made pictures of landscapes void of people, you know, like their presence might somehow be imbued on that space. Even if it meant leaving space within the picture for a piece of writing that could perform as a portrait. And it performs the right word.
No, it's such a complicated decision.
It came with the help of my son, who came and visited me, who's 31 years old, comes up in a different generation, and just could not abide by any engagement with refugees that involved a potential transactional relationship, where I was asking them to be a subject for the camera,
right?
A subject for my book, and bring something to my work in exchange for what, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the help was in being part of this, or volunteering or participating with the organization that was doing the real logistical work, right? That was the real service. Yeah,
it was the real service, but also giving my attention to them at a time when they were offering their stories.
Right.
Because I mean, through this work, I'm always reassessing what my job, what my role is as a photographer. And since working in Calais and working with these images in post to create exhibitions and books, my revised notion of what my job is to pay attention and cultivate compassion. Those are the things that I have narrowed it down to: paying attention, cultivate compassion, empathy. And that came from making that decision along with some guidance from my old soul son to do that. If you do that, everything else that follows is, I won't question it as much, you know?
Right. You can feel confident in where you are working from.
For better or worse. I mean, if the project ends up falling to pieces, at least like I'll feel okay. I mean, as that as opposed to delivering what I felt at the time was a prescribed format or form of the photo book, which is to include portraits.
Right.
Sort of to include a rounded vision of a place. Portraits, locations, atmosphere, still life.
Text like, and right.
Text.
Right.
Give us like take us there.
Yeah.
You know, we want to go there.
Right.
But how do you do that without distilling, diluting?
Or not being you too, right?
Yeah. I mean, I could be me within that space, but I don't think it only stood to lose something deeper, you know, and something that tries to be more truthful, you know, and also an opportunity for growth. Like, what if I didn't do portraits? What would that allow for? And what it allowed for was creating a space, the space for the viewer, the space for me, the space for a writer to enter in and invoke a being, a presence by way of words that to me was expansive and inclusive.
Absolutely.
It didn't close down around immigration and refugee. It became more about a universal thing of what it is to be, to feel alone in the world, to not have, to not have a voice, to be unseen.
Yeah.
To question notions of shelter, of, you know, so it just became to me an opportunity to sort of to open things up a bit more.
Yeah. Weld's poem, long form poem, is this sort of tragic story of loss and struggle and searching for someone, you know, I mean, there's this just this deep humanity.
Deep humanity. Yeah.
Yeah. In your photos and the poems, and that's how they are aligned.
Very much
right?
So. Yeah. The goal that we had that was unspoken in the beginning and then became acknowledged, we were both doing it, was that we were both sort of trying to allow the foregrounding of the other's work. So my pictures that I was editing and working with were not heroic photographs that took a lot of oxygen. They were more banal, everyday occurrences that I tried to photograph that would leave an opening for the text and an opening for the viewer and their imagination, and especially in combination.
Exactly.
And so I was wanted my images to recede a little bit so that George's writing could be foregrounded. And George was doing the same thing. He was wanting, he was pulling back on the text so that the pictures could be foregrounded.
Right.
But within that generosity that we were both showing towards the book, like it wasn't about being generous. I mean, it was being generous towards George because I really admire his writing. Mm-hmm. But it was more about what, like being generous towards the possibilities of what this book might be able to deliver.
Yeah. And they both have that open-ended, thoughtful quality to them. That openness to us sort of placing ourselves within the story, within the narrative.
Yeah. But George, beyond his writing, is a special human being in the sense that he inherently has a humanity and a generosity and a graciousness and a deep empathy. I think one of George's hardest things was to sort of shelve any form of advocacy in this work, to have it be about the plight of the immigrant and the injustice of that plight.
Right.
That every human being wouldn't have their basic needs met. Like, how is that possibly fair? You know, those books are valuable and those books exist. But for me, and ultimately for us, to make a book like that would close it down and would make it political. It would create a polarity.
A specific political quality. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we wanted to try to avoid that, not to shun it or not to put our head in the sand, not to bury it.
Right.
But just to open it up a little bit also.
I just want to ask you a little bit in terms of color work, which you also used in previous work. What is the role of that? Is that a chapter break? Is that a pointing something out? What's the role of the color work?
Well, I think color, the use of color in a more minimal way can possibly bring form-based images in black and white into sharper relief even. So like, you know, to have that pause in the middle of the book that where things move to color, and even the environment and the atmosphere shifts a little bit, does a couple of things. I think this book is decidedly longer than most photo books would be, both in the number of images and the inclusion of text that requires more of a commitment on the reader, the viewer. So it's sort of a way, it's a palate cleanser in a way.
That's what
it does.
It's a
pause.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also then, like I said, it also, I think, brings both the pause and moving from black and white to color and then back to black and white brings both into sharper relief.
Yeah.
Makes it more pronounced.
There's a heavy richness to your black and white work. And when those color pictures pop up, it's almost like a breeze hits you in the face.
A breath, exactly. Yeah, you're coming up for air.
Yeah.
Even though the pictures are all about like being underwater.
Right. Right. Yeah.
All of these choices, though, and you know, I very much related to what Jenny was saying in her talk earlier about these choices not being one that applies reason or logic.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jenny was very helpful in this book because whenever I would say I'm doing this because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I could reason or provide logic to. She would urge me to like not do it for that reason. You know, your reader is as smart as or smarter than you are. If you're doing it and you know why you're doing it, they're going to know why you're doing it. You're not going to. So don't pander.
Right.
Keep the whole work suspended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't have it like come down because now we know what you're up to.
Yeah.
Oh, you know,
that's really great advice.
Yeah.
Have you had responses to the work and reactions? What did the commission think?
The commission loves the work, both the first exhibition and Hermes loves. Yeah. And I've worked with David Campany throughout both the book.
How nice.
The book, David Campany, Michael Mack, Morgan at Mack were all instrumental, as well as, you know, my close friends, my partner, just all of it, you know, that they're all instrumental. I mean, I have a very small community of people that I rely on. It's 3 or 4, maybe 5 people, plus Campany and Michael, just to keep the thing from getting too focus grouped or distilled, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But they love the book and the exhibitions. The response in general has been very slow. Michael Mack cautioned me in the very beginning. He said, this book is not going to take off.
Mm-hmm.
It requires something of the reader. And I've spoken to a few people about the work, and I would say 2/3 of them have said, yeah, I'm halfway through, you know, at the time. And because you know, and at first I thought, well, what does it take to like sit down and like, you know, spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes going through the book. But it's actually really gratifying to hear that like people want to take it slow.
I think that's great. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, Michael said, this book will not sell out right away. It will eventually. It may sit for a while and then be discovered and all of a sudden it'll be gone kind of thing. He's had that experience as a publisher. But to me, the fact that we had the support of Hermes, they took what's at stake in terms of the cost of making the book and the work. They took that equation out of it for me.
How nice. Yeah.
Which was really nice in the sense that I believe, and George and I believe very much in this work. Mm-hmm. We stand by it. Wholeheartedly, we just both feel like it's the best thing we could have made in that short period of time, especially. And we believe in it and we're not attached to like it's any sort of success that, you know,
right.
Something that might deem it as successful, whether it sells out or has awards or is written about, you know. So,
I mean, it's such a little bit of a luxury in a way to work, obviously, right? But, but it really does mean that, you know, this is the work you really wanted to do.
Yeah. Without knowing it's the work I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But it has completely shifted the way I think about making work close to home. I just got back from the desert in Southern California. I was making work in a residency there, sort of a cobbled together residency opportunity where I positioned myself. I was staying in near Joshua Tree in the Morongo Valley, but I was working in the lower desert near Coachella, Indio.
Uh-huh.
And I discovered this one setting where I realized like I don't have to drive anymore in search of looking for you know signs or clues. Like I'm going to set myself down here. This place where I'm going to photograph provides me the sort of backdrop for inner projection, you know.
Right.
From this space, with this space, I can look strictly for form and mark making that registers with what I'm feeling internally.
Yeah.
And this space can become a projection of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's So the work that I made there was very much guided by the merging of what was happening in that space with what was happening inside, like
right.
what I was feeling emotionally at that time, which was pretty heavy. So it became a way to exercise.
Yeah. This has been effective. There's a part of this that you're going to have as an influence in your work.
Completely. And, you know, my friend Tim Carpenter talked about this idea of a portable subject
mm-hmm.
before. And I don't know if I still understand exactly what he means by that, but what I've taken it to mean is that the portable subject is this thing that we carry with us, you know, and that we can unpack anywhere we land up, essentially.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, you started to describe that when you landed in France, right?
Yeah. So that's where it sort of began. And again, I just don't think there's any, I just can't believe that this is all coincidental.
No.
Like it totally feels like I'm on a journey that sometimes I have the illusion I'm controlling it, but ultimately I think I have very, very little will or control over.
Yes.
My responsibility is to show up.
Right.
Well, and as prepared a state as possible.
I imagine you've already seen it. You go through that 30 years of work and you find a one photo that you keep making over and over again.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's something in that, making that one.
Yeah.
Because what that does is like that one photo or that one way of making the picture mm-hmm. becomes a standard from which you can more accurately gauge not what's happening in terms of your evolution as a photographer, but what's happening in terms of your evolution as a human being,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, how am I evolving? How is my vision evolving? How is what I care about and where I want to focus my attention evolving? What do I prioritize now? You know, like that's interesting to see that shift in evolution.
Absolutely.
Now.
Yeah. I think that's a great place to end on. Thank
great.
You so much.
Great.
This was a wonderful conversation.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
This is a great space you've created.
Like, Thank you. It's a little echoey. I don't know if that's coming through the podcast right now. Hopefully I'll be able to edit that out.
It's real.
Thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Right. Bye, everyone.
Bye, Michael.
Photo Work with Sasha Wolf is a production of the Photo Work Foundation. Executive producer is Sasha Wolf, and the associate producer is Taylor Selsback. The show is also produced and edited by me, Michael Chauvin-Dalton of Real Photo Show. Music is by J. Walter Hawks. If you like the show and wish to find out more about the foundation, please visit photowork.foundation and be sure to subscribe and review with all the stars on your listening platform.